my brother's 60th birthday. I phoned him. What's wrong with being 60? What's the problem? Something about age and all that kind of stuff. So in yesterday's chapter, I was left in India. The monk had left me, right? It's a cliffhanger. So there I am, all inspired to become a monk, and my monk disrobes. Not good. So I hung around in India for a while, and then got hepatitis, and somehow made it back to Europe and got my health back together and worked in Switzerland, and then I remembered what I was supposed to be doing. Went to Thailand, and through fortunate circumstances found myself in northeast of Thailand with a teacher called Ajahn Chah. And I was very fortunate because I came into a culture which was a very simple, very, very simple culture, and yet it had, and yet, maybe that's not right, but it had a lot of wisdom. So it wasn't a technologically sophisticated culture, to say the least, but there was tremendous wisdom there. And so I was able to imbibe Buddhism in a complete cultural package, not just as a oddity in North American culture. I saw it very whole, where the whole society, that particular part of Thailand, had a tremendous. All of Thailand does, but there was something about the northeast of Thailand. They say in Thailand, if for monks, they say if you want to go walkabout, go to Chiang Mai, go to the north. But if you want to find a great teacher, go to the Isan, the northeast. And for some reason, some cultural reason, this part of Thailand produced some of the best teachers Thailand has seen in the last century, Ajahn Chah being one of them. And what I saw there was that the Buddhism wasn't just a kind of a psychology or a thing called vipassana, you know, or some kind of a technique. It was a complete way of life, and it was practiced both by the monastics and the laity, and the some of the lay people that came to meditate in Ajahn Chah's monastery is very impressive meditators, very, very adept, very skillful. Put me to shame, that was for sure. And then I took the robe, and then they'd bow. And no, don't do that. Don't bow at me. So I took it very personally. And of course, it wasn't about me, it was about the aspiration. And I knew for darn sure that these people were much better meditators than I was, much more adept. But in that culture, and I've really seen that in all the Buddhist folk that I've met, there's a tremendous emphasis on generosity as the basis for the spiritual life. So whether it's my Sri Lankan friends, or the Lao people, or the Cambodians, or the Thais, or the Burmese, and the Malaysians, the Vietnamese, this kind of joy and generosity. It's the joy of giving, the joy of serving. And the sometimes when Buddhism just comes out of a cultural context and is brought to another culture, sometimes we just take one aspect of it. So Westerners seem to have picked up the psychological part and the meditative part, which are very, very, very important. But it was interesting for me to see that this wide body of cultural skills that existed for these people. So these devotional chants, iconography, just this ritual now of asking for the Dhamma talk, just that little thing, a kind of formality and a reverence and a great beauty in that. And we can't replicate that exactly, but I think it's important to remember that there's much more to Buddhism than just watching your left nostril. Other things too. And generosity is when the Buddha gave the, sometimes the Buddha would give a graduated teaching, he'd always begin with generosity, and then he would move to morality and then bring other things. And generosity, the benefits of generosity were always emphasized first. And in generosity, what you have in your mind is you have more space. When I've got excess, I can give to you. Then I'm not so selfish. I'm not just trying to grab my own. You know, I'm not in this world always just for my own particular needs. So generosity is a spaciousness and a joyousness of the mind, of one's life, really. A very important part of the life. So I've seen that, say, in monastic communities where if monastics go into it with a sort of, give me my space, give me my hut, give me my meal, these are my rights, my human rights, and just let me get the jhanas, and you guys clean the toilets, and don't bother me, I'm meditating, they're miserable. They might be good meditators, but they're usually pretty unhappy, because their whole practice is predicated on getting something for themselves. So that the danger in a meditative life is that it becomes self-obsession or self-serving rather than letting go of the whole ego trip. It can be really reversed that way, and you can justify it. Quote the suttas: I should be alone, I should be doing this, and I should be meditating. But it can still come from a sense of me trying to grasp something for myself. And Ajahn Chah certainly played with that. We'd be wanting to meditate, and he would just create work projects. Just these work projects. He built this weird thing at the front of the monastery, which is actually concrete thing, which was actually knocked down. And he knew he was doing it just to make us work. And then you'd say, yeah, but I want to meditate. He'd say, well, why can't you meditate on concrete? And there was one American who, we had started this Western monastery called Wat Nanachat, and there were 11 monks in the beginning. So there were about 7 at that time. And Gary, he just wrote, his name was Gary, I forget his ordained name, but Gary went to Ajahn Chah and said, I want to go practice with Ajahn Sumedho. Ajahn Sumedho had started this. And Ajahn Chah said, well, what's wrong with me? And then he kind of delivered all these different kinds of reasons why he wanted to go there, and Ajahn Chah just kept countering him, because Ajahn Chah just wanted to tell the truth. And finally said, listen, I want to talk English and drink coffee. And I just said, well, why don't you tell me? Go ahead. So the whole thing of really being honest is important, because the rationalizing mind can always excuse greed, hatred, and delusion, all kinds of interesting and fascinating ways. We've all seen that. So Ajahn Chah's constant refrain is, why do you suffer? Why do you suffer? Well, it's because the monastery is not right. Good luck. So you wouldn't have the nerve to go to him and say, can we change the schedule? And this is what one learns in Sangha life. And now, I know lay people use the word Sangha to name a community of practitioners, but the very word community and Sangha, as it's used in the Pali tradition, is really a group of individuals who are living together. And that's a different kettle of fish. community as a dispersed group of people who come together on a Friday night is community. But when you have to live together and share the showers and the soap and the food and, you know, all the time together, that's a whole different kettle of fish. It really is different because you really start to rub up against each other. So now we've been together for 3 days, and now you have sangha. Now you really have sangha. You don't just have you don't have your own little scene where you can do what you want and adjust it and have your, you know, right tone of lighting and set up your shrine and have your right kind of music, and you don't. You have this. And within that, there's going to be something you don't like. Some things you like, some things you dislike. Now, if you believe you're disliking mine, then you'll think, well, my disliking is the absolute truth. In other words, if we rearranged it this way, it would be a better retreat. Which is delusion. Which is just the self coming up and saying, I want it my way. Frank Sinatra singing in your head, right? Let's do it my way. But it's not your way, it's this way, right? And in Buddhism, we talk about, I like to think of it as social Buddhism and flow of consciousness Buddhism. Social Buddhism is the Buddhism where we use the sense of I and the sense of responsibility. So it's about ethics. It's about the way we relate to each other. It's about the precepts. It's about our responsibilities as individuals. So in social dharma, social Buddhism, I as a monk have certain rules that I live by. And if I break those rules, Ajahn Kusala and Venerable Pavaro, their duty is to tell me, Venerable Sir, that's not what we do. You should not do that. And then I have to change my ways. So they have to help me to wake up to my misbehavior. So I have a responsibility. So there's a sense of I, there's Virodhammo, and all the rest of it. Flow of consciousness Buddhism is then the other part of Buddhism, which is the phenomenological experience of consciousness. Not only do I live as an individual with my individual responsibilities, I am Virodhammo and so on, but within that social kind of thing, there are feelings and memories and likes and dislikes and inspiration and disappointment, pain in the knee, the whole thing is going on as a flow of conscious events. And that part of it is where we find the liberation, where we find transcendence, where we realize nibbana. The social part is necessary because that's how we can live together. If we didn't have the social part, we couldn't live together. So we need the social part, and that's where the sense of I is used in Buddhism. Flow of consciousness, well, that's just all the events that we're experiencing. And if in those events we suffer because of something, it's our responsibility to find out why we suffer. So if on this retreat now, there is something that gets up your nose, something that irritates you, you have an option. You can try to change it. I wouldn't put any money on it. But you can also consider, is this immoral? Or is this just my preferences not being satisfied? Is this a felony? So it's interesting on a retreat how little things can get up your nose. Someone's too slow in the food line, or someone's too loud closing the bathroom door, or someone leaves the door open, or someone leaves the door closed, or is it too hot, or is it too cold, or someone comes in late, or someone leaves early, and all these very important felonies that you experience. So you gotta keep a perspective on this, is that now that we're in this situation, we're surrendered to this, now the defilements will come up. It's not like all of a sudden you just sit down, Galilee, beautiful Ottawa River, and boing. It doesn't work that way. Why? Because the flow of consciousness is also involved with habits and patterns. And part of those habits and patterns are patterns of suffering. We all know that, right? And so going back to the ideas of purification and abandonment, when defilements come up into the mind, when you feel annoyed, when you feel that what I'm saying is, you know, that I should say more, that I talk too much, that I talk too little, you know, that we chant too much, or we don't chant enough, or whatever the complaining mind does, see that as complaining mind. If you see that as complaining mind, then you're seeing flow of consciousness, you're seeing complaining mind, and you establish witnessing on that. And if you're establishing witnessing on that, that's non-attachment. If, however, you think, and if you're very clever, quite often this is the problem, that actually this isn't a complaint, this is truth, then you're in trouble. Because that truth will lead you by the nose for 9, or for what, 7 more days? Why do you suffer? Right? Well, it's because they do that. Or he does that, or she does that. And when there's attachment, there's a sense of me and other, or self and other. When there is knowing, there's, oh, this is just the complaining mind. And you don't have to get rid of it. You just witness it, and if you really witness it and feel it in the body, then it ceases, and in the cessation there is peace. And that's purification. A habit pattern arises dependent on some kind of contact, sense contact. It might be from a memory, it might be from something on the retreat. You might have some idea of how a retreat should be. Maybe you just listened to the latest Arahant on the block, and you know the talk should be that way, or maybe the retreat was run this way, maybe the food was done that way, and the mind compares. Because the mind thinks, well, this is the way a retreat should be, or this is the way a teacher should be, or this is... And the mind makes these kind of judgments and comparisons and takes positions. You know, this is the way it should be, because we did it that way. But again, is it immoral? Is it a felony? Is it a problem? Or is it the mind that's the problem? And I would suggest that it's pretty good. And I'd also suggest this, if you can't be free now, when? If you can't be at peace now, when is it going to be? When is it going to get more perfect than this? I doubt it's going to get more perfect than this, really. Honest. I mean, I've seen situations, and so have you. So, take responsibility for your own suffering. Don't project it out, because you'll never be free that way. There's no chance for freedom. Why do you suffer? Why? Because I want things to be other than they are, or I don't want what is here right now. I want something else. Very simple. So the flow of consciousness presents material. Some of the material is things like aversion, intimidation, anxiety, self-consciousness, embarrassment, all kinds of negative things come up. And when those things come up, it's very important to see that's where you work. Because in that moment, when those negativities arise, that's where purification can take place. Let's say I feel disappointed by something in my practice. So maybe I had this wonderful idea of maybe in the last retreat I really had good samadhi. Right? And now I'm just a basket case. And my mind's all over the shop. And then disappointment comes up. I say, oh, I feel disappointed. And then I start to create a self around that. Oh, my practice is no good. And that's attachment. But if I just feel disappointment feels this way, then I'm looking at flow of consciousness. I'm not creating a self around that. That's not attachment. Disappointment is still disappointment. Again, that's just the way the mind's going to work, because we have expectations. We can drop expectations. But if I just know disappointment as a force, a type of mood of the mind, and what, so then what is letting go? What is letting go? It's not creating a self around that, not creating a personality around that, not creating a problem around that. Seeing it as a sankhara, seeing it as a conditioned phenomenon dependent on conditions. Feeling it there and saying, ah, this is a condition of mind. This is flow of consciousness. And the more I do that, purification takes place, because then the pattern of attaching to disappointment, attaching to aversion, attaching to all these things, those patterns become less powerful, less real. And as those patterns get less real, what becomes more powerful is the sense of witnessing, the sense of knowing, and that's where the peace of the mind is. Not in the movement. You'll never get it right on the sense of movement, because movement is always, you know, sometimes it fits what you want and sometimes it doesn't. So the liberation in Buddhism is not fulfillment of your desires. If you think that's what it is, then you'll be forever disappointed for many a lifetime. It's not the fulfillment of desire, it's the abandonment of desire. It's different. So there's something that arises in my mind where I feel I don't want to be this way. What's the liberation there is, oh, this is wanting. Wanting feels this way. Then the abandonment of wanting is the witnessing to unfulfilled desire. It goes through me, I witness to it, and it ceases, and that's the third noble truth, the realization of the ending of suffering. There's suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's the cessation of suffering, there's the path which leads to cessation of suffering. Suffering has to be understood, the cause has to be abandoned, the cessation has to be realized, and the path has to be developed. So if you can do that, if you feel some kind of desire, whatever it is, comes up, you want to get some attainment or whatever, or you want someone to be different than they are. Look at this is wanting. Wanting feels this way. Can you really just witness to a mind of wanting, not make any judgment about it, and just know it, and know it as in its ending. See how it ends. See how it ceases. And in the cessation, there's peace. Vice versa, try to rearrange things and get them right to your specs is a recipe for disaster, because you'll never get it right for your specs. In social, if we talk about social Buddhism, and I'm not talking about social Buddhism, you have to get those two right. We have to do things, obviously. We need to address problems and so on and so forth. But in the context of a retreat, we have this lovely opportunity. We don't have the opportunity to change the furniture, but we have the opportunity to watch our desire to change the furniture. And that's a freedom. It's a different kind of freedom. So the best attitude to take is just pretend, you know, you've got your little place here. You've got your bed. You've got your seat. Maybe you've got two seats now. And see, the chairs are increasing back there. So you've got, you know, you've got your little empire. And take the attitude of being someone who is at a train station. There are no terrorists. The train is on time. You just have to wait for 7 days. And just watch. Watch the trains come and go. There's a dirty train. And you don't have to phone up Via Rail and say, you guys should clean the windows. Just watch the train, dirty train, come and go. Watch people come and go. Take that attitude. Have you ever been in, like, dentist, people are afraid of dentists. You know, some kind of appointment, right? And it's, you know, it's not anxious or whatever. And you're just really relaxed because there's nothing to do. Nowhere to go. You're on time for your appointment. So you just watch. Oh, yeah, there's that person. And you're quite observant, aren't you? Oh, yeah. Oh, wow, look at that one. Hmm. And you just, so the same with your mind now. You sit down, or you walk, and you watch, and you watch, and you watch, and you watch. And then you watch why you suffer. Why do I suffer? Suffering has to be understood. What's the cause? The cause is attachment to craving. Wanting something that you don't have, or not wanting what you do have. Simple little mantra. And the realization where the mind is freed from wanting. So bring up that realization when all the time. Like that's why I say start the meditation with just a sense of ease. Just listening. and get a feeling for nowhere to go, just sound, and get a feeling for the mind which is relaxed, just at ease, nowhere to go, just that, no craving, no desire, you don't have to figure anything out. That really, very simple, very, very simple. And listening, that. What does he mean by listening? What should I listen to? No, just listen. Just that, just open, relaxed, attentive. Find those places in your mind, because they're there throughout the day. Usually it's when the bell rings. You're finally liberated from the sitting. You bell and you relax. Oh. Okay, what does that feel like? Or you just go out for a walk. Just get a feeling for the mind which isn't making a problem, which isn't suffering. And then see how the mind creates a problem around something, around simple things. And the lovely thing about a retreat is that the things we create problems around, if you step outside of it and think about Darfur, you'd be embarrassed, wouldn't you? But the mind has defilement. That's the problem. Some of the things I would get upset, you know, get upset about someone having a bigger sugar lump than me. You know, if I think about it now, it's so embarrassing. But the aversion was real. I mean, I did deserve a bigger sugar lump. We get these cane sugar things. I was always craving sugar. You know, I'd look at the other guy's bowl and really, and I'd, you know, feel annoyed or jealous of his sugar lump. And at one hand, I said, oh, come on, then we'll grow up. And yet, on the other hand, the defilement was quite real. And that's the beauty of a retreat, is that the things that we find fault with are pretty Mickey Mouse, if you think in the larger scale of things. And if you keep that perspective, then you can see the defilements, but you can also say, oh, wow, give me a break. Then you can process it. If you think those things that, you know, if you really believe in them, like let's say if you feel like self-conscious or paranoid, those can be very strong states of mind. If you have a panic attack, say something really, really heavy like that, it's a safe environment. You're okay. You're okay. So if you feel everyone's looking at you, then okay, this is a feeling of self-consciousness. You're okay. You know it's safe. You can feel that. No problem. You don't have to be a personality. If you feel lonely, this is loneliness. Really get in touch with anything like that and see that it's just a movement. Just a movement through the mind. That's all. It's not real. It's not who you are. It's just movement in consciousness. And there's this strange thing called awareness. What is that? Isn't it strange that you can witness to all kinds of bits and bobs and that witnessing stays? It doesn't go away. It has no quality. But it's there. And that, you begin, as you practice in this way of non-attachment, you begin to find your refuge in that, and you begin to see how wonderful witnessing and awareness is. That it's okay to feel lonely. That's one of the interesting kind of joys of the meditative life, where you have some nasty bit of old karma come through the mind, and you just witness it. You don't react. And it goes away, and you think, wow, isn't that neat? I didn't suffer. That's a kind of interesting kind of joy. It's not, you know, it's a joy of seeing there is a freedom even within that. You got lots of memories come up. And sometimes you feel that you've really worked through something, right? You got closure on that one. Or you've really forgiven that one. And lo and behold, no, there it is again. You know, you're strangling that guy again. Now, where's that coming from? Oh, I thought I had closure. Maybe I should do more forgiveness practice. Don't create a self around it. It's just memory. Not a problem. Not nice. It's just a bad smell. You get bad smells and good smells. Don't make a problem. It's just a smell that's coming through the mind. So you can have, like, a memory will come up. It's amazing memory, isn't it? How you can have a memory from 10 years ago, which can feel almost quite intense. And if you panic and oh no, my practice isn't working, no, that's just, if you say, oh, that's just memory. memory feels this way. Then witnessing gets stronger with memory. If you have some awful, you know, let's say you did something really awful to someone 5 years ago, and you get this uprush of guilt, and then you, you know, oh, why did I do that? I should never have done that. Well, have you been doing it for 5 years? Well, if you have, yeah, then stop. But maybe it was just a, you know, just an off day, or an off decade. Whatever it was, it's not now. So the guilt comes up in your mind. That's just guilt. Guilt feels this way. Attachment is creating a self around it. Non-attachment is just knowing guilt as guilt. The idea that non-attachment means you never feel anything is not the way the mind works. It has memory. That's just a part of its function. It needs memory to function. Otherwise, we'd all have Alzheimer's. So memory's okay. And some of the memories are unpleasant. You know, we've kind of really blown it with someone or whatever, and then they'll come up. That's just memory. Flow of consciousness. So the flow of consciousness is, it's always kind of challenging you to stay centered, stay in the center. So what we do is we meditate, right? And we do these little things with the breath and with the body just to kind of learn how to stabilize the mind. But in the meditative posture, it's more obvious this is just flow of consciousness. These are just thoughts and sounds and memories going through. So we become adept at noticing flow of consciousness. And then when we do walking meditation, it gets a bit more, maybe not so obvious, but it's a flow of consciousness. But it's the same practice then throughout the retreat. We're becoming adept at watching flow of consciousness. And then hopefully we take that into ordinary life to watch flow of consciousness. And so I suggest now that, the retreat is this way now. This is the schedule. These are the people we're with. We're not going to throw anyone out, right? Because no one's misbehaving. Everyone's great. You're all great practitioners. Obviously, if someone started to, you know, came in drunk as a skunk or lit up a joint, I'd say, hey, whoa. That's not on. But no one seems to be doing that. I haven't smelled any marijuana in the hallways. No one's eyes are glazed. So it's okay, it's all right. But the idea that I like everyone in this room is a bit naive, isn't it? So metta practice is just not hating people. If you think you should like everyone, then you could really do yourself a bad turn. But you can watch dislike arise and cease, or you can attach to dislike. So maybe there would be something, the way someone does something, the way they move around, or, you know, all these significant things that we attach to. Maybe it rubs you up the wrong way for some reason. Is it immoral? Is it a felony? If not, notice this, just that, how your mind likes to latch on to something. So let's say there's, you know, the person maybe next to your room always clicks the door too loud, right? And now you keep focusing on that negative thing. They did it again. And then you notice them coming in. There they are. And you get obsessed with, you know, this Mickey Mouse thing called clicking doors. That's aversion, right? And then you develop this hating relationship with the person. Then you talk with them on the Sunday and find out they're wonderful. No perceptions. And because there's nothing really significant to attach to, the mind will latch on to little things. And that's the beauty of a retreat. You realize it's really, you know, it's not a big deal. So then you hate yourself. Then you go that way. Now I should stop hating that person that clicks the door. I'm a terrible person for hating that person. It's the same schlamazel, isn't it? It's just thought. But if you just go, this is what the body feels like. This is what stress feels like. This is what dukkha feels like. Then you're touching it before it goes into thought, before you create a self. And then you can just learn to relax the body, learn to relax the guts or whatever. So it's not a matter that we're going to, you know, like everything for the next 7 days. Life isn't like that. But the idea that that everything should fit your desire pattern, is that a winning strategy? Can't be, can it? You know, this monastery is designed for my desire system. This is, well, I mean, I've thought that way. I confess. You know, that Ajahn Chah should give talks just to the length that I want. And the schedule should be set up just so when my knees start to hurt, they ring the bell. And the food, of course, the food should be brown rice and what I want. And then I get the kuti with it, and it goes on and on. But life is this way. So practicing in Sangha is very, very interesting because we're supportive to each other, because it's wonderful to practice with a group of people, but there are frictions. It's going to be, has to be. And the frictions are, of course, where you learn a lot. As Sangha, we're making the intention to support each other as much as possible on this retreat. So we make the intention to practice noble silence. So that's a kind of a responsibility. So now we go to social dharma. So I was talking about flow of consciousness dharma. Now we go to social dharma. Social dharma is we do have responsibilities. If we're going to live as a community, we can't just do our own thing. So we have a responsibility to live by the precepts. We have a responsibility to live by the renunciant precepts. We have a responsibility to be sensitive to each other. We have a responsibility to practice noble silence. We have a responsibility to care for the place, not to, you know, to make sure that the taps aren't open or whatever. To be responsible for the place we live in. So that's our social responsibility. And then within that, we watch our minds. And we have different standards of quietness or whatever. So the more you can just give up to that, give up to your responsibilities and do what we're supposed to be doing by the schedule and so on, and then watch, just give up. Then you have a lot of freedom. But if you keep trying to get it right, don't go there, because it'll be, you know, that very thing will just keep hounding you. If there's one person that you think should change, then they're going to be sitting in your cushion for the whole retreat. In your mind. So then we do practices like metta bhavana. Now there's a question here which, just to finish off this little question. That's a question I couldn't answer. When I do the metta meditation, as I bring up the image of my son or my mother, at first my heart tightens and I cry. I wish them well, but I know they do or will have pain. Should I choose some other image? So the purpose of meditation, in metta meditation or other types of meditation, is to set up a strength of mind which can deal with suffering. Okay? So the purpose of metta meditation is not healing, although it could be healing for your body, but that's not, in meditation, that's not, it's not to kind of send out loving vibrations to other beings all over the planet to heal them. That's not what it's meant for. Maybe that works. But it's simply meant, in meditation, is to bring a mind, to give a mind the strength of kindness, which then can deal with aversion. So when the mind has a lot of kindness, it sees aversion more clearly. And it can apply the medicine of kindness to that which one is averse to. Okay? So quite simply, if the mind is just getting worried or depressed, don't go there. Because for those two people, this person already has enough love. It's not that they hate them. So just simply get the mind to that tone which is kind and generous. Generous. And then when the mind goes into criticism or aversion, see that imbalance. See what's happening. That's all. So just choose enough images to get the mind there, and then let go of the images and practice just flow of consciousness awareness. That's, so it gives a power. Or like the breath. What you're doing is the breath, you're learning to stabilize consciousness, stabilize the mind, so the mind has the strength of stability. So when the mind starts to go off, you say, oh, it's going off for some reason. Body awareness, same kind of thing. You're using the body to compose attention. The mind has stability. Then when the mind goes off and the body feels it, you notice it. So it's like the platform for vipassana. It's the platform for investigation and understanding. If our minds are just all over the shop, of course, we can't see suffering. So we need to compose the mind. We need to do exercises like this. So do it a lot. And learn how to train the mind to be calm. Train the mind and get a feeling for what the open heart is, and then see how it contracts. Because that's very quick. If you get a body sensitivity to that, fear and anger are so quick to see them. And you don't have to go off into the mind, oh, I shouldn't be angry, you see it in the body. So the more we train in samatha practices like that, balance practices, composure practices, stability practices, call it what you will, then the more easily it's easier to see imbalance, how those take place. One question, maybe a yoga teacher could help me, please. Please, why is it important to breathe from the nose instead of the mouth? For me, my mouth goes dry, but anyone in the yoga schools want to venture? Colleen? Other mouth.
Yeah.
And has it got to do anything with pranayama? Okay. Because in yoga, the teachers are always saying breathe through the nose, aren't they?
Yeah, but I mean, you don't want to be breathing through the nose all the time. But sometimes
yeah. Yeah. And it just dries things up. Okay, I'll leave that for tonight.